there is real truth in we don't feel seen. We don't feel like we can survive on this particular salary. We don't feel like we're listened to, right? There's truth to that. And organizational leaders, there's real truth to we can't raise everybody's salaries. We don't have the funding. Those constraints are real. You know, not everyone can be part of decision making. We will never get anything done if we have a fully democratic, you know, one voice, one vote on everything we decide to do as an organization. And, you know, hierarchy is in place to pursue a mission and a strategy and a vision. But there's truth to both. And we were missing some real shared concepts and shared understandings of even the environments that we were working in.
My guest today on Mission Impact is Rebecca Epstein. Rebecca and I discuss her article that she wrote with Missangette Smith, published in the Nonprofit Quarterly in 2023. The article was called Paving a Better Way, What's Driving Progressive Organizations Apart and How We Can Win by Coming Together. Danielle Marshall and I also talked about the article in episode 75. It was written in part in response to another article that I'll list in the show notes. The article explores what nonprofits can do to address the internal conflicts in nonprofit organizations, especially social justice-focused organizations, that have been rife over the last few years. These conflicts have often been on generational and racial and other identity lines and have pitted staff and leadership against one another, often sparked when staff do not feel like the organization is living the values it says it has. I have often talked on the podcast about the cognitive dissonance between the missions that organizations that I worked for when I was younger had, and then how they managed internally their staff and how everyone was treated. And as I've described before, this led me to the field of organization development, and ultimately to the work that I do today. It was interesting to reflect on the difference between then and now and how those internal conflicts played out. In the 90s, we could talk amongst ourselves as staff about the gaps we were seeing between espoused values and lived values. And if it got really bad, we might go talk to a board member. But the whole conversation was usually contained inside the organization. There was no social media to post on to make public our concerns. There was no glass door to put a review up about how the organization was run. And if we published an open letter, at most, it would be seen by those within the organization. Today's reality is very different. Call-outs can be very public, and when posted on social media, even have the potential of going viral and traveling well beyond the organization's boundaries. And as I've explored in past episodes, I believe we're also in the midst of a shift in how many people are seeing the place of work in their lives, the implied contract in employment, and what they expect of their workplace. But not many organizations are having really focused conversations to address these expectations. I especially appreciated Rebecca's point that being really clear about what she calls your strategy house is so important. Essentially, getting your strategy house in order means ensuring that your organization's mission, vision, values, theory of change, and operating principles and practices all align. And then as you clarify those, working to make sure that everyone in the organization has a clear and shared understanding of them. Many of these conflicts explored in the article stem from widely different concepts of what it means to work, what it means to lead, and what you, quote, bring to work and what you don't. I've talked about these types of conversations and having them internally when I talked to Mala Nagarajan on episode 85. As you hire new staff, are you being clear about your conception of what being an employee is and the expectations? Are you clear about when they will have a chance to weigh in on decisions and when not? Rebecca also talks about being clear about what your history is and how you conceive of the work you're doing and your theory of change, your operating principles, as well as your fundamental values and how you actually live out those values. And when you have these conversations, you take steps to avoid the types of conflicts Rebecca and I discuss. Mission Impact is the podcast for nonprofit leaders who want to build a better world without becoming a martyr to the cause. I'm Carol Hamilton, your podcast host and nonprofit strategic planning and evaluation consultant. Mission Impact is brought to you by Grace Social Sector Consulting. Grace Social Sector Consulting brings you whole brain strategy consulting for nonprofits and associations. We help you move your mission forward, engage all voices, and have fun while doing it. We combine left brain strategy and analysis with right brain wisdom about human complexities for a proven whole brain, whole organization process through which every stakeholder thrives. Reach out to us for support and facilitation of strategic planning, mapping your social impact, as well as auditing your services for mission alignment. We especially love working with staffed nonprofits and associations with human-centered missions. Well, welcome, Rebecca. Welcome to Mission Impact.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So I always like to start with a question of what drew you to the work that you do? What would you say motivates you, or what would you describe as your why?
I am most motivated to make the world a better place by eradicating racism, systemic injustices, and building pro-democracy in this country and the world. And so that got me my start as an organizer, and that led me to try to help organizations that are doing that work every day do it as effectively as possible with leaders that are grounded and aligned in their values, and organizations that are clear on their purpose and their mission. I believe that we can get to the world we want if we have the strongest organizations and leaders possible who are doing that.
That's awesome. So that leads very directly to what we're planning to talk about today. You and Missinget Smith wrote an article that appeared in Nonprofit Quarterly in 2023, so last year, called Paving a Better Way, What's Driving Progressive Organizations Apart and How to Win by Coming Together. And that article was in part, but I don't think entirely, in response to another article in the Nonprofit Quarterly called Building Resilient Organizations Towards Joy and Durable Power in a Time of Crisis by Maurice Mitchell. Both of the articles centered on the current and ongoing, I would say, generational conflict that's going on, well, probably in the wider society, but also in the nonprofit sector, in social justice organizations and movements between Boomer and now Gen X leaders and Gen Z and millennial staff. And interestingly, I was thinking, well, you know, the first article was written in 2022. The second article was in 2023. But I just got a newsletter from the Stanford Social Innovation Review, and the very top line article for the January 4th edition was Learning from an Intergenerational Blow Up Over Social Justice by Stephen Kagan and John Hagan. So that's a long way to get to where I wanted to just start, which is kind of what was some of the backstory or to leading to the two of you writing that article?
Yeah, and thanks for raising the context. I mean, what we were seeing in a way that in my 20 plus years of working with social change organizations I had never seen before was just an intense level of conflict within the organization, primarily between staff and leaders, primarily cutting across those generational lines that you mentioned, but not exclusively.
Not exclusively, okay.
So I do want to include that. I don't think it was just generational. I think, you know, racial differences, cultural differences, some of which cut clearly across generational lines, but others do not, were coming to play. And we were living in a time that was unlike any other that I had ever lived in my lifetime. I'm 46. And so the pandemic combined with the racial uprising in the wake of George Floyd's murder were creating conditions in which we had never been further apart, literally. We were in our homes, mostly on Zoom, so really fractured in a physical way. And we were experiencing intense fractures as a society. People were feeling alone, concerned, scared, and we were revealing, you know, having the wool taken off our eyes, sadly, you know, for the first time for many white folks, especially around the real racial cleavages in society. And so we were addressing the issues that were kind of confronting us had never been so stark in terms of tensions and frustrations and a call for change. And also the conditions we were living in had never been so isolated. And so that gave rise in some, I mean, on the heels of a Trump administration and on the Muslim ban and on just, you know, just so many policies and a real sense of fear of what this country was actually going to come to. Like, was our start going to realize itself? You know, was white power going to be the dominant trend of this century? Really in a call for change. And that call for change came on the streets and it came within organizations. And as a consultant and as a coach, I felt for the first time in my work that I did not have the tools to help. Mm. You know, I say, if you're familiar at all with the Management Center, which was an organization I helped to start and trains managers on how to be, trains progressive leaders on how to be effective managers, you know, MoCA wasn't going to save us. SMARTY goals were not the answer, you know, nor really was, you know, just good process or procedure or even clear vision or strategy. This was deeper. And we needed to address it in a deeper way. So that was really the impetus. I was so pleased to see you mentioned Maurice's piece, just such a brilliant essay on the trends that he was seeing. And he really started to say the quiet part out loud that I think a number of people were feeling, that we were getting in our own way. Mm-hmm. And that if we wanted to have real impact, the kind of impact we need when our climate's in crisis, when our democracy's in crisis, when we have white supremacists running for national leadership and actually in national leadership now, we need to be more aligned than ever. And at the very time we needed to be more aligned than ever, we were really drifting further and further apart. So that was the impetus. You know, the specific challenges, we were seeing open letters from staff to leadership calling for changes, accusations of racism, accusations of white supremacist practices by leadership, a lack of listening to people most impacted by the work. You know, some of these are not new, but what was new was the fervor of the demands and the height of tensions. That were leading people to really just call for wholesale change. And some of those changes were actually impacting Black leaders, leaders of color, Black women who had come into positions in part because, you know, white-founded, white-led historical organizations were saying, we need to take this seriously. We need a change. We've got to get out of our own way. We need to install new leadership that actually can carry us forward and does represent, you know, the views and ideologies and lived experiences of those we're trying to empower. And those were some of the leaders that were bearing the brunt of the attacks and of the demands. And so,
because the expectation for those folks is even heightened. More so. Like, I think There's expectations in these organizations that they're already going to, by default, by existing, going to be somehow outside of all of the norms that we live within, and that you know, the mission that they espouse, you know, there definitely should be alignment, right, on the inside. I experienced this, you know, in the 90s when I was a younger person. But I think a couple differences, clearly all that context that you're talking about. And then, you know, if we saw as younger staff concerns about our leadership, we talked to each other in the hallway about it. We didn't have social media and open, you know, if we wrote an open letter, I don't know who it would be to, probably the board. Yeah. The level of access or transparency wasn't there. So,
yeah,
as you said, it's always been there. And then yet so heightened with everything else that was going on.
I think that's right. And I do want to add that there, you know, the New York Times did a great job on Israel Palestine, saying like it was so immediately clear you had to pick a side. You know, what side are you on? Who's on the right or the wrong side? And I think that activism and organizing and movement work has often been pick a side. It has been everything is binary. There's a right way and a wrong way of doing things. And that mentality was, I think, very evident in the open letters, the demands, the if you're in leadership, you know, not only do we not trust you because you're in leadership automatically, there's a gauze of skepticism, or you've got to prove that you get it. But also just, okay, now we're holding you accountable for all the flaws of this institution right away, and you have to fix them right away. And it was a very binary way of working. That said, I think staff also, you know, and we tried to be balanced in the piece because we also understand that staff members who are making these demands were feeling real pain and feeling mm-hmm, a real mm-hmm. lack of alignment with their leaders and with their organizations and wanting to see change at a wholesale level. And their pain was also real. And so demands for, you know, pay equity or decision-making rights were really coming from a place of wanting to have agency and also rising inflation, rising costs, you know, mm-hmm. like $80,000 seemed, you know, like $1 million when, you know, a couple decades ago. Sure. Now that has really changed. And I would say our salary pay has not kept up with the shifting economy. So there is, I think, what we were trying to show in our piece and what I've gotten more in touch with now, if you know polarities work at all, each side has real truth to it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There is real truth in we don't feel seen. We don't feel like we can survive on this particular salary. We don't feel like we're listened to, right? There's truth to that. And organizational leaders, there's real truth to we can't raise everybody's salaries. We don't have the funding. Those constraints are real. You know, not everyone can be part of decision making. We will never get anything done if we have a fully democratic, you know, one voice, one vote on everything we decide to do as an organization. And you know, hierarchy is in place to pursue a mission and a strategy and a vision. But there's truth to both, and we were missing some real shared concepts and shared understandings of even the environments that we were working in. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to lose the perspective of the staff too, who have very true lived realities. The tactics that were being used, I think to your point, were new in their, you know, in how loud they were. Social media, you know, public calling outs were newer. But the felt lived reality, you know, was not so new in some mm-hmm, ways. It mm-hmm. was just coming to a head in a different way because of the moment that we are in and the tools available.
Yeah. And I mean, shifting expectations as well, right? As we each, every time we try to do better, then it's like, well, that's good, but let's do better.
Yes, right. Like, and the arc so bending each, toward justice is important.
So,
yeah,
right. And so at each generation, and okay, so I'm still in the generational piece, and you're saying, well, it wasn't all generational gaps, but you know, as time moves forward, you know, it's a good thing that people's expectations rise around, you know, how work should be done and you know, what the experience should be inside of an organization, and come into that with a different kind of bottom level, if you will, than perhaps previous generations who might have put up with this, that, or the other.
Exactly. And I think there can be a sense of martyrdom from the previous generation to say, well, I went through it, so now you got to get through it. And
right.
This like awestruck take on young people standing up and demanding justice, you know, some leaders just saying like, wow, I would never have the ability to do that. Kind of good for you. And also, let's all get kind of on the same page about what's possible and where we are. So I completely agree that there's the saying that happiness is the gap between your expectations around something and the reality. And I think mm-hmm. starting in 2020, that gap felt bigger than ever for many people coming into progressive organizations. And so therefore the unhappiness was greater than maybe ever.
It felt like a magnifying glass on everything, yeah. right? The kind of ripping open and as you said, you know, for many white people, like opening up and seeing things that they'd never seen before, and yeah, just a felt of you know, this must change now. So one of the things that you kind of talked about was the kind of differing approaches and concepts around leadership. And I'm wondering if you could kind of talk a little bit about that and how that played out or how you're seeing and maybe how it's evolving now.
Say more about leadership.
So, you know, what does it mean to have shared leadership? The whole thing you were talking around, you know, being involved in decisions, how do decisions get made?
Yeah.
Oftentimes my experience has been that It's how decisions get made are usually one of those implicit norms in, in an organizational culture. So it isn't super, people don't necessarily have a shared understanding of what that is. And so you may come in as a newer staff person and say, I've got a lot of ideas and I want to be involved. And as you say, taking that agency and wanting to contribute. And yet, you know, the reality that if you're needing to move towards perfect consensus on everything, you will end up in complete paralysis.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Helpful. Yeah. So one of the things that we talk about in the article is power and how power works in organization. Our point that we were trying to make is that the organization needs to be coherent in terms of its orientation toward power and build structures and systems that reflect that ideology. And so, for instance, in a power building movement based organization that's trying to build a base of people to organize them around whatever social issue at hand, if the theory is people need to be empowered, then there needs to be a way for people to be empowered in that organization too, right? You can't be hypocritical about how you run your...
You can be,
and then you're going to get an open letter and you're going to be held accountable and all the things. And so one of the things that we were trying to say is that organizations need to do a much better job being explicit about who they are right from the get. So this is what we believe. These are our values. That is really the foundation of, you know, when Maurice Mitchell says we need to do better at strategy. You know, the strategy house is a tool that I've created and use in my work to help organizations get better at strategy. And organizational coherence starts from that. So what are our foundational values and beliefs about the world and how we should be? What is our purpose as an organization then becomes the floor of the house on top of that solid foundation? Where are we trying to go? That is the roof. What is our vision? That's the tippity top, you know, in an ideal world, this would be true. And then what do we think needs to happen to get from our mission to our vision? That's our theory of change. What's our analysis about what's getting in the way right now and why that vision hasn't already come to be? And what specifically are we going to do to advance that theory of change? Are our strategies or the levels of our house, right? With measures of success and all the good management tools built in so you can track your progress and adjust it all that. Leadership and how power works in the organization should be reflective of your strategy house, of your theory of change. So just to give an example, if you're a base building organization and you have nobody from your impacted community on your board of directors, which is your ultimate powerful body that's saying yes to your budget, you hiring your executive director, doing all the fiduciary things that it's required to do by the IRS, and we can have a whole separate conversation about whether boards are useful and how they've developed over time and all the things. But working within the construct we're living in a capitalist system, we're living with the IRS, we're living with boards. How should your board be made up? Who has power in your organization, right? So a different way, rather than everyone should have power, how can you function effectively while still reflecting your values and your theory of change and your vision in your operating practices and principles? And can you be explicit about those things on the front end so when people are coming into the organization or into specific roles, they understand, oh, this is how the organization makes decisions. This is its strategy house. This is who it is. And I get my role in that ecosystem. I know what power I have and what power I don't have. I know what I'm going to be consulted on, what I'll have decision-making input around, and what I won't and why, and I get it. And then we're coming in a way, hopefully, where our expectations are closer to the reality. Maybe they don't exactly match up, and that's where we can, you know, have process internally and hold people accountable and have all the things to express grievances and give feedback and work well together. But without that foundation, we're really setting ourselves up for failure and deep, deep disappointment. And allowing people to project their own values and beliefs onto the system, which then gets us into having to have hours and hours of internal meetings about things that should have been clear in the beginning. Now, let me just say, those things
can
and should change.
That's not easy, though, to get to that
place. It's not easy. Well, I don't think it's as hard as organizations think it is. You know,
okay,
I do strategy. Some organizations, I just finished up a 2-year strategy process that with deep, you know, hundreds of stakeholders and lots of input and lots of deliberative discussion. And yes, some organizations need 2 years. I think smaller organizations can do this work in 6 months. And I think the value of spending that time is then limitless and priceless in terms of the dividends it will pay of having that kind of clarity and something to return back to inform both our external work in the world and our internal work. So I don't know if that answers your question on leadership, but in my view, like decision-making and all of that has to start from who we are as an organization and our ideology. And we need to be willing to put the power and the success of the organization before our own individual self-interest, right? That's working with power. If I'm working in an organization, I have to believe that what's in my self-interest is also in the self-interest of the organization. And if the organization is successful, I'll also be successful rather than the other way around.
Yeah, and just going back to that clarity piece and kind of investing the time, because I think with a smaller organization, obviously you have fewer people to involve in that process. And at the same time, I feel like in smaller organizations, that's where things are often the murkiest because everyone's moving so fast. Yeah. They have so many demands, so under-resourced that it's really hard. And it feels almost like a luxury to spend the time talking about all those things. But as you're saying, if you don't, then you just end up having to deal with the conflict and the static later anyway. Yeah. It's not like you avoid it.
Right.
And so it's not, there is a certain way of that you should pursue your leadership. It's what I'm hearing you say is more your leadership and your decision-making processes and all of those things need to be in alignment with your identity as an organization, your purpose, your mission, your vision.
Yes.
Which I think people intuitively know when they see a gap, but it's harder to think about what's actually an aligned organization that has all of that clear.
Yeah, I think there's no perfect organization out there.
Sure,
everybody is in stages of growth and development and learning and being iterative. But what having that clarity allows you to do is iterate more transparently. So for instance, you know, what should we do in this situation is a lot harder to figure out if you don't have a touchstone to come back to. You're starting with a blank slate. And also, like, how should those things change? It's a good question to ask yourself, you know, every few years. What has shifted about our environment? What's shifted? Does our mission need to change given the world we're living in? You know, and those are just very healthy conversations. I'd rather have conflict around the fundamentals than conflict around the symptoms.
Yeah. And I think the conflict shows up as conflict around the symptoms.
Yes.
Can you give me an example of what, like, when we're talking fundamentals versus symptoms, what that might look like?
Sure. So I was working with an organization several years ago, kind of bleeding into the 2020 time, that hired me to help them set clear goals. And so the symptom of the problem was that they just weren't sure what they were trying to achieve. And as we did that work, it became clear that they could put anything they wanted on paper. But what was really going on was a lack of trust among leaders. And the lack of trust among leaders was because I think they all had different theories of change for the organization and what it should be doing. And so we were working on a management challenge that was really a leadership and a strategy challenge. And you could say, okay, that we should have done a better job scoping the work. And I'll take that criticism. As a consultant, we say, yes, that's one of the things we need to do a much better job of not just responding to leaders and what they say the presenting symptoms are, but really getting to know the organization, listening to staff, really doing more of a holistic assessment on the front end so that the work that we end up doing is not just addressing the, you know, what's at the tip of the iceberg, but the underlying causes as well. So that's a good example where we were never going to get out of fundamental conflict unless we addressed what was going on between the leaders and what they really believed the strategy to be and what was most important to their strategy. Was it campaigns or base building? You know, was it about building power for whatever people wanted, or did they have an issue agenda? you know, how did electoral work fit in? What was the analysis about short-term electoral work versus long-term base building? What was their, you know, what was the balance there? And until they really had those conversations about what their organization was all about, anything we were doing was just window dressing.
And one other thing you said, you said organizations should look at that every couple of years. And when we started talking, you also said, you know, things have shifted a lot, like on, I can't remember the exact words you said, but like on their axis or something. So Say more about, you know, it's now been a couple of years since all of the context that you were talking about. What are you seeing now?
Well, when I said the world had shifted on its axis since we last spoke, I was specifically referring to October 7th and the aftermath in the war in Gaza. And I think we're seeing, you know, our article feels like we were addressing small bore issues when you look now at what's happening on the left and the real cleavages we're seeing around stances toward Israel-Palestine, analysis of what's going on there, of who's in the right, who's in the wrong, and what should happen. And so I think what we're seeing is just the continuation of the cycle of disconnection play out in progressive spaces and coalitions, but at a much larger scale, and around one particular issue that has deep, deep complexities, even so much as people don't agree on the historical facts of the region. And so when we talk about coming down your ladders of inference to get out of the cycle and kind of coming back to a shared understanding around some core concepts and some core things so that we can be operating in alignment and our expectations generally match the reality and we're able to work together, I think I am just seeing even larger gaps than before and ladders of inference that don't come back to any shared fact base, which makes it really hard to work through differences and conflict because we're just starting in such different places. So I think what I'm seeing is, in some ways, the level of intensity of the internal conflicts has come down a bit, especially last year. I wish that our group had published our piece, 2 years earlier. I think it would have done a lot more good. Ultimately, it was a meaningful process, and I think the work was better as a result of having so many contributors and so many eyes on it and voices in it. But I think by the time we published, the conflicts were less acute. They were less felt. People were feeling a little bit better about the day-to-day, but they hadn't really resolved some of the deeper fundamentals. And now what I'm seeing, especially in Jewish but also non-Jewish organizations, is just we are missing some of the fundamental tools to have the hard conversations that we need to have so that we can get to a shared understanding of where we are and come up with our own organizational work as a result. And some of that's playing out internally between staff and leadership. Again, open letters are coming up again, demands, unions, one of my clients received a letter signed by 1,000 people demanding that they call for a ceasefire, so there's a lot of wrestling going on with constituents, about trying to figure out the right way. One thing that if I were to write the piece again now, I would focus on more is something called parts work. I don't know if you're familiar with internal family systems and Richard Schwartz.
Just becoming familiar, yeah.
It's a very powerful coaching methodology that I think is also very relevant at an organizational consulting level and thinking about systems. So the notion of parts work, and I won't do it justice, but the idea is that we all have many, many parts. No parts are bad, but they have different functions. You know, there are many parts that are protecting us from feeling, hurt, trauma, pain, anger, fear. They don't want us to feel those things. They will do anything in their power to keep us safe. And there are other parts that actually have experienced those things, whether it's intergenerational trauma, or abuse or neglect or fear, and those tender parts live in us too. And the goal of coaching and the goal of ultimately consulting and hopefully my work in the world is to help people and organizations act from self. And self is grounded, it's confident, it's calm, it's clear, it's compassionate, it's curious, because it knows who it is. And it can manage the parts that come up when they come up. So fear raises its head. Oh, hello, fear. I know where you're coming from. Can you step back now? Because we need to have a conversation, you know? And right now, I think our organizations and many of our leaders are and staff are captured by their parts, which are acting out of a real fear, you know? So on the left, people are understandably desperate to stop the bombing in Gaza and ensure that no more innocent people are killed. And on, you know, in mainstream Jewish organizations, they say, well, of course we don't want the death of innocent life, but Hamas is out to eradicate us as a people. And so we have to defend ourselves. Otherwise, Jews may be no more. Both of those, there's fear motivating both sides in different ways. And if we could get to self, we, I think, would be able to hold much more of a both and perspective. So this is a long answer to your question around, I think what's happening is we are missing some tools and some skills. When we get to the skill part of the article, I think another skill I'd put in there is really trying to get grounded in self and act from self as an organization that's grounded in your strategy house and grounded in your values. That's a clear way. Okay, this is who we are. How do we act from that place? Even if some of those things are in dynamic tension with each other. And as a leader, it's, okay, I have this part that's really fearful and this part that's really angry and this part that just doesn't know what to do. How do I get grounded so I can act from a clear place that's grounded in my values and my convictions and my beliefs and holding those things? And if we were all able to act more from self, my hope, my dream, my belief is that we would be able to find more common ground and be able to act more powerfully together as one. And you know, that is what I try to do every single day in my work. But it's really complicated and it's really hard. And the demands on leaders and organizations are incredibly intense. And so, you know, I think some of this is muddling through and trial and error and trying to just be in dialogue and understand each other's perspectives so that we can come, we can ground in our own beliefs and work from there.
Yeah, a couple different things in what you said. One, I think there's parallels when you said, we talked about the ladder of inference and, you know, at a societal level, people not being able to agree on the history. And I mean, we've experienced that with, you know, our own country's history around racism, around the genocide of indigenous people, that there is an agreement there. And then the other piece around, you know, talking about parts and that comes out of trauma work. And then there's so much, all of these, I could probably say this is almost like an absolute, like every justice seeking organization comes out of some trauma that people are experiencing, either individual and probably individually as a group,
yes,
as an organization, systemically, like at all levels and intergenerationally. And so then all of that, those trauma responses are being kicked up. And yeah, folks have, I don't think we have the tools, the experience, the knowledge as organizational leaders to manage or cope with that. Maybe, you know, maybe organizations are starting to kind of be trauma-informed from a maybe who they're serving perspective, but not at their core of like, what does that mean to do? I mean, I've been thinking, but not necessarily coming to any answers or any conclusions, but you know, how do organizations pursue equity and have a trauma informed lens?
Yeah, it's such a good question. It's so complicated, and I think
knowledge around that is just growing in leaps and bounds, and yet is also so rudimentary in some many ways.
And people who are doing healing work are so important right now into our movement spaces. And I would say one of the parts of the article that we try to really emphasize is organizations need to be really clear on what resources they can offer staff around in supportive ways and what they cannot. Not because they're bad or they don't care, but because that's not their expertise and they may or may not have the resources to do it in the way that it needs to be done. And so I think organizations also need to be clear on you know, are they hiring people who already have skills and tools for managing their own resilience? Is that an important part of their hiring? Because they know the work is so great and that they can't spend the time and energy training people on how to do that, you know, or is this a development place where they're saying, no, part of our work is to help people build resilience. And so we're actually going to invest in that too. So again, that comes
and
back.
Probably also on a continuum, right? Because, you know, I often am always, you know, talking about building healthier cultures and being able to, you know, invest in wellness for people on staff. But there is an outer limit to that your boss is not your therapist.
Right. And they're not trained to be that. They can't be
right.
That
I mean, maybe a few people are, but even then, they're not trained to be that in that relationship.
Yes.
That's a different relationship. And so, you know, kind of seeing where and again, getting some clarity instead of murkiness around what is it that the organization can work with and what needs to be, you know, what healing work do you need to do elsewhere?
Exactly. And again, just being clear about it. I really do believe there's no one right way to be a movement-based organization. I do think organizations need to do a much better job getting clear on their way, why it is their way, and what that looks like in practice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. Just as we wrap up here, just have one last question. On each episode, I ask each guest, what permission slip would they give to nonprofit leaders, or what would they invite them to consider to avoid being, we talked about martyrs, to avoid being a martyr to the cause and as they work towards cultivating a healthier organization. So what permission slip or invitation would you offer?
I think I would offer something that just builds on what I just said. There's no one right way to be a leader. The first permission slip is just be thyself, and to be thyself, one needs to know thyself. So really taking the time to understand your motivations, understand your own values, understand your own theory of change, know what gets you, you know, one of my coach advisors says hooked, you know, what gets you triggered, what pulls you off your base, and skill up on the things that you need to get back to who you are. And then really just make sure that those things are in alignment with the organization that you're leading. And if they are, fabulous. Stay there. Do as much good work as you can. Continue to learn and grow. If they're not, that's okay too. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's so important to know when there's a gap between your own orientation and your organization's orientation. And things can change over time. And so I always say to my clients, you know, staying put is not the goal here. You know, if you find that that this organization isn't a place where you can continue to grow and nurture who you are, then it's time to leave and find a place where you can do that. So that's what I would say. Know thyself, be thyself, continue to adapt thyself, and be in places where you can be thyself.
Awesome. I love it. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for this conversation.
Thanks, Carol. It's great. So good to talk with you. I appreciate all the good questions and the opportunity to reflect back almost a year later on where we are.
Thank you for listening to this episode. I really appreciate the time you spend with me and my guests. You can find out more about how to connect with Rebecca, her full bio, the full transcript of our conversation, as well as any links and resources mentioned during the show in the show notes at missionimpactpodcast.com/show notes. I'd like to thank Isabel Strauss-Riggs for her support in editing and production, as well as Shardé Carbonell of 100 Ninjas for her production support. And we'd like to hear from you. Take a minute to give us some feedback or ask a question at missionimpactpodcast.com/feedback. And until next time, thank you for everything you do to contribute and make an impact.